Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Okay, imagine this scenario. You've got two people, right? And both of them carry the exact same dominant genetic variant, one known to be linked to serious stuff like, say, really high cholesterol or certain types of diabetes. But here's the kicker, the real puzzle. One person, they develop severe symptoms, you know, needing serious mental health. And the other person, they're basically fine, perfectly healthy, maybe, or perhaps the disease shows up, but it's super mild, almost unnoticeable. How is that even possible? I mean, this isn't just some abstract thought experiment. It's a huge challenge right now in genomic medicine. How can we possibly predict who gets sick and like how sick they'll get when the genetics seem so, well, so fuzzy? It's a fascinating puzzle, this variability, and that's exactly what we're diving into today. And, you know, before we even start trying to piece together the answers, we really have to give a shout out, acknowledge the huge effort that went into this research. This wasn't small potatoes.
Oh, absolutely not. You're spot on. Today, we're really celebrating some incredible work by a big collaborative team, mainly folks from UCLA and also the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. They just made really significant strides in understanding why these genetic diseases hit people so differently. It's a major leap forward, honestly, in teasing apart all those complex genetic factors that influence, you know, whether disease shows up at all penetrance and how varied the symptoms are, expressivity.
Right. So let's unpack that a bit. For a long time, I think we sort of viewed many genetic conditions as pretty straightforward, didn't we? Like one broken gene equals you get the disease. End of story. But it's turning out to be, well, a lot more complicated than that.
Precisely. Yeah, the old view is a bit too simple. We're often dealing with what are called autosomal dominant monogenic diseases. Now, that just means you only need one copy of a, let's call it a pathogenic or disease-causing variant in one specific gene to potentially get the condition. But what's really eye-opening is the scale. Over 3% of the entire population actually carries one of these dominant pathogenic variants.
3%? That sounds like a lot.
It is. And yet, just like you said, only a fraction of those people, the carriers, actually develop the disease they're supposedly at risk for. And even when they do, wow, the symptoms can range from barely noticeable to extremely severe. It's a huge spectrum.
Okay, so that's the core question then, isn't it? What explains that massive variability? Why isn't it just like flipping a switch? You have the variant, you get the disease, same way every time.
Exactly. And this study we're looking at today tackles that head on. It meticulously investigates three sort of main ideas, three factors that scientists have thought contribute to this incomplete penetrance.
Right, that term meaning not everyone with the variant gets sick.
Yep. And also variable expressivity, which is just the scientific way of saying the symptoms vary a lot from person to person. So the three factors they dug into are, first, variable variant effect sizes. Basically, the idea that even within the very same gene, not all bad variants are equally bad. Some might only slightly mess things up, while others completely break the protein's function.
Okay, so it's not just a binary broken, or not broken, but like, how broken? A gradient of effect, almost.
You gotta think dimmer switch, not on off. The second factor is polygenic backgrounds. Now, this is about the combined effect of, well, thousands, maybe even millions, of common genetic variants scattered all across your genome. It's like your overall genetic predisposition, right? The sum total of all these little nudges that can make you, as an individual, slightly more or less susceptible to something. It's like a background noise that can either amplify or dampen the effect of that one single major variant.
Okay, so your whole genome kind of sets the stage. And the third factor, you mentioned it gets a bit more complex.
Yes, the third one is marginal epistasis. This is where things get really interesting and arguably the trickiest bit to pin down. It's about how your entire genetic background, those common variants we just talked about, doesn't just add up, but actually interacts with and modifies the effect of that single pathogenic variant you might carry.
It corrects.
Yeah.
Modifies. So not just adding effects together, but one influencing how the other behaves.
Exactly. It's not additive, it's interactive. Think of it like chemistry. Mixing two chemicals might do something completely different than just having them sit side by side.
Can you give an example? That sounds quite abstract.
Sure. Let's take the MC4R gene again. It's famously linked to obesity. Now, some variants in MC4R definitely cause severe obesity, as expected, but, and this is the wild part, other variants in the exact same MC4R gene have been found to actually protect people against obesity.
Wait, in the same gene? Some cause it, some protect against it.
Right. It strongly suggests there's a complex interplay happening. The effect of a specific MC4R variant seems to depend on the context of the rest of your genome. It's this interaction, this epistasis, that can flip the script. It's incredibly challenging to study, but potentially holds huge predictive power.
Okay, yeah, that makes it much clearer. But wow, tackling all three of those factors, variable effects, polygenic scores, and epistasis sounds like a monumental task. What kind of data did they even use to get at this?
Monumental is the right word. They needed massive data sets. So their main source was the UK Biobank. They used exome sequences, that's the protein coding parts of the genome, and linked clinical information from hundreds of thousands of participants. We're talking huge numbers, like the 200,000 and then the 450,000 exome releases.
Okay, UK Biobank, that's a familiar powerhouse.
Absolutely. But crucially, they didn't just stop there. They made sure to replicate their key findings in a different large data set, the Mount Sinai Biome Biobank. This includes, I think, nearly 30,000 participants. And importantly, it's a more ethnically diverse cohort than the UK Biobank.
That's key, isn't it? Showing it's not just a fluke of one population.
Exactly. Replication across diverse populations really boosts confidence in the findings. It shows the effects are likely more generalizable.
So they had the data. What about the methods? How do they actually isolate and measure these three different sources of variability? Sounds statistically challenging.
Very challenging. They employed three really cutting-edge statistical genomics methods, each kind of specialized for one piece of the puzzle. So for digging into those variable variant effects, they use a method built on something called the ESM1B protein language model. This thing is seriously cool.
Protein language model, what does that mean?
Well, think of it like AI models trained on human language, like GPT.
Yeah.
ESM1B was trained on millions and millions of known protein sequences, learning the language of proteins, basically. It wasn't trained specifically on disease data. Because it understands normal protein structure and function so well, it can then look at any possible amino acid change, any mutation in any protein, and generate a score predicting how likely that change is to mess up the protein's function.
Whoa!
Yeah, it allows for a much more nuanced classification than just pathogenic or benign, especially for those tricky variants of uncertain significance, or VUS, where we just don't know their impact. It predicts a continuous score of potential disruptiveness.
Okay, that sounds incredibly powerful, almost like predicting the dimmer switch setting for each variant, even ones we've never seen before.
That's a great way to put it, exactly. Yeah. Then, for assessing the polygenic background effects, they use polygenic risk scores, or PRS. These are pretty well established now.
Right, those combine the small effects of many common variants.
Precisely. They sum up the tiny contributions from thousands, maybe millions, of common variants across your genome to give you a single score representing your overall genetic liability for a trait, like high cholesterol. What they did here that was neat was looking at very fine-grained quantiles, like the top 1%, top 0.1% of PRS, to really see the impact at the extremes.
Gotcha. More precision there. And what about the third piece, that really complex epistasis?
Yes, marginal epistasis. For this, they actually brought in their own novel method, something they developed called FAME, which stands for Fast Marginal Epistasis Test, testing for interactions between a rare variant and potentially millions of common background variants is computationally brutal. It's been a major bottleneck. FAME is designed to do this much, much more efficiently. It quantifies how much that common genetic background modifies the effect of the specific pathogenic variant you're interested in.
FME. Okay, so a specialized tool to hunt for those complex interactions at scale. And what specific conditions did they apply all this tech to?
They focused on common cardiometabolic conditions, things affecting the heart and metabolism. These are perfect candidates because we know they're influenced by both rare variants and common polygenic effects. So specifics included familial hypercholesterolemia, that's the genetic kind of high LDL bad cholesterol. Also familial hyperalpha-lipoproteinemia, which is actually high HDL, the good cholesterol. Familial hypertriglyceridemia, so high triglycerides, certain types of monogenic obesity, and MODY, which is maturity onset diabetes of the young. And importantly, they didn't just look at disease-causing variants. They also included known beneficial variants in the same genes, like ones that naturally lower LDL or protect against obesity. That gives you the full spectrum.
Right, looking at both sides of the coin. Okay, so they had the massive data, the cutting-edge methods, the specific conditions. What did they actually find? What were the big results when they put it all together? Did these three factors really explain the variability?
The short answer, yes, absolutely. Their findings provided really strong statistical and clinical support for all three mechanisms playing a role in that variable penetrance and severity. It was quite striking. So first, on the variant effect differences, remember that ESM1B protein language model? They found its scores predicting how disruptive a variant is were tightly correlated with how severe the phenotype was in carriers for, I think, 6 out of the 10 gene phenotype pairs they studied closely.
Okay, so the predicted brokenness score actually matched up with real-world patient outcomes.
Exactly. And the MC4R gene example was particularly telling. ESM1B didn't just predict BMI differences among carriers. It could actually distinguish between the gain-of-function variants, the ones that protect against obesity, and the loss-of-function variants that cause it.
Wow, that level of nuance is incredible, beyond just bad or good.
Totally. It means ESM1B could offer much more specific prognoses. And crucially, it provided potentially meaningful predictions for literally thousands of those VUS variants of uncertain significance, giving us clues. Before, we just had question marks. Plus, it actually outperformed all the other standard variant prediction tools they compared it against.
That is a huge deal for clinical interpretation. Were these ESM1B findings solid, though? Did they replicate?
They did. That was key. They showed the ESM1B scores were predictive, even for extremely rare variants, which are often the hardest to understand. And yes, the results held up when they checked them in different UK biobank data releases, and importantly, in that independent, more diverse biobank cohort. So, strong evidence. Okay, second finding, the polygenic background. This was also really significant. They found that polygenic risk scores had a major impact on the phenotypes of people carrying pathogenic variants. For conditions like monogenic obesity, high HDL, the LDL lowering variants, high triglycerides, a carrier's PRS score independently influenced how severe their condition was. But here's the part that really makes you rethink things.
Go on.
They found that hundreds, even thousands of people without any known pathogenic variant but who happened to have extremely high polygenic risk scores, actually had more extreme phenotypes like higher cholesterol or BMI than some people who did carry known pathogenic variant but had a low PRS.
Wait, hang on. So your general background genetic risk, your PRS, could push you further into the risk zone than someone who actually has the disease gene but a protective background.
Precisely. Yeah. It's a powerful demonstration that the common variant background isn't just noise. It can be a major driver of risk, sometimes even outweighing a single high-impact rare variant. It really emphasizes looking at the whole genomic picture.
Mind blown. Okay. Yeah. And the third factor, epistasis, the interactions.
Right, marginal epistasis. This, for me, is maybe the most profound finding for where personalized medicine could go. They found widespread statistical evidence that the common genetic background directly modifies the effect of the monogenic variant through these epistatic interactions. They quantified this using a metric they called the epistatic improvement percentage, or EIP. This basically measures how much better your prediction gets when you account for these interactions compared to just knowing if someone is a carrier or not.
And what were those EIP values like? Were they small tweaks or big changes?
They were often substantial. The EIP ranged from about 48% up to a really staggering 170% in the significant associations they found. For LDL cholesterol, for instance, the EIP was 170%. That implies a model incorporating epistasis could be like 2.7 times more accurate in predicting someone's LDL level than just using their carrier status alone.
2.7 times. Oh, that's not right. Subtle.
Not subtle at all. It strongly suggests these interactions aren't just a minor footnote. They are major players in determining how a pathogenic variant actually manifests in an individual. It's not just the parts, it's how the parts work together.
Okay, this is genuinely painting a much richer, deeper picture of genetic influence than the simple single gene model. So, stepping back, what does all this mean? What are the big implications of these findings for, you know, the future of genomic medicine and maybe even for us, just thinking about our own health risks?
Well, I think this study really lays a crucial foundation. It moves us definitively beyond simplistic explanations. It clearly establishes that things like incomplete penetrance and variable expressivity in these monogenic conditions aren't mysteries driven by just one thing. Instead, it's a combination. The specific impact of the variant itself matters, sure, but so does the cumulative effect of your entire polygenic background and these complex interactions, the epistasis between that rare variant and your common background. All three are demonstrably important.
So we really need to think in terms of a genomic profile rather than just single risk genes.
Exactly. And the implications for medicine are potentially huge. This work sets the stage for a radically better prediction. Think about it. Instead of just telling someone you carry the variant for condition X, which might be terrifying, but not actually tell them their likely outcome, future clinical reports could integrate all this information, the variant-specific effect score, the person's PRS, maybe even key interaction effects. This would offer a much more accurate, personalized prognosis. Imagine knowing not just if you carry a risk variant, but getting a reliable estimate of how likely it is to affect you and maybe even how severely.
That would be transformative for genetic counseling, for deciding on preventative measures, even for tailoring treatments.
Absolutely. It could change the entire conversation around genetic risk.
But as always in science, I'm guessing there are still challenges, right? Limitations to this study or next steps needed.
Oh, for sure. The researchers are very upfront about the limitations. For one, they mainly looked at the standard or canonical forms of proteins. But proteins can exist in different forms called isoforms in different cell types, and how those variations play into this is still largely unknown. Another tricky issue is that measuring penetrance itself isn't static. Think about it, screening guidelines change, doctors get better at diagnosing things earlier, diagnostic thresholds shift, and maybe the biggest confounder now is widespread medication use.
Ah, like statins for cholesterol or the new weight loss drugs?
Exactly. If lots of people in a study population are taking statins, their LDL levels might look artificially low, masking the true effect of a hypercholesterolemia variant. Or new obesity drugs could lower BMI, again making it harder to see the pure genetic effect on weight. So these real-world factors complicate the picture.
Right. Successful treatments can ironically muddy the waters for genetic research.
It's a challenge. And then there's the issue of diversity. To really make these sophisticated models work for everyone, globally, we need even larger biobanks that capture the full spectrum of human genetic diversity. Genetic backgrounds vary across populations, and crucially, those VUS variants of uncertain significance are far more common in people of non-European ancestry, partly due to historical biases in who gets studied. So applying these models requires careful validation in diverse groups to avoid making health disparities worse.
That's a critical point, ensuring equity as these technologies advance.
Definitely. And finally, this kind of complex analysis, integrating rare variants, PRS, and epistasis, will likely work best for quantitative traits, things you can measure on a continuous scale, like cholesterol levels, blood pressure, BMI, because you need that fine-grained phenotype data, which biobanks often collect.
Makes sense. But despite those hurdles, the overall potential here for more precise, truly personalized genomic medicine feels enormous.
It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, the development and validation of tools like ESM1B are game-changing. Having AI that can look at a variant, even a totally novel one, and give a nuanced prediction of its functional impact, maybe even tell gain of function from loss of function, that's huge. It opens the door to finally classifying thousands upon thousands of VUS that currently leave patients and doctors in limbo. This study powerfully underscores why we need to integrate everything, rare variants, common variants, interactions, to build that complete, personalized genomic profile. It's the path towards genuinely empowering precision medicine. So if we had to boil it all down, what's the big take-home message from this really deep dive into our genetic complexity? I think the core message is this. For many conditions, especially complex ones like cardiometabolic diseases, carrying a single bad gene variant is really the whole story. Your unique genetic blueprint, which includes the specific punch packed by that variant, plus your overall background genetic susceptibility from common variants, and the subtle ways all these parts interact, that whole package is what really shapes your risk and potential outcome.
It's the combination, the interplay, that matters. So the final thought perhaps is, what does this shift towards integrating all this layered genetic information really mean for the future of preventing and treating disease? Maybe even for you personally, something to definitely mull over. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this analysis, the best way to support Base by Base is to subscribe or follow in your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. It only takes a few seconds, but makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science Base by Base.